Oh my gosh, it really is Christmas in February. It is snowing in New Hampshire. They're supposed to get a lot of snow up there, and the primary is only 4 days away. What more could political junkies like the people gathered in our studio and all of you out there listening to the show wish for than a snowstorm right ahead of the New Hampshire primary? I'm Bill Nigut. Welcome to the Friday edition of Political Rewind. We're so glad you could join us. With us today, Kyle Wingfield, columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You know, the AJC likes to show its readers that they are split evenly among political philosophy. So, Kyle, you're listed as one of the conservative columnists
for the
paper. Senator Nan Orrick, a Democrat, joins us. We're very glad that you could be here, Nan Orrick.
Thank you.
And Todd Rehm, who is the editor of GeorgiaPundit.com and a Republican political consultant, back at the table. And back again, we're so glad he could be here, Mike Thurman, who has so many titles, we're never sure which ones to use. He's a Democrat. He ran for the U.S. Senate in 2010. He was the DeKalb County School Superintendent. He was Commissioner of the Department of Labor. You've been all over the map, Mike Thurman.
Some guys just can't keep a good job. Right?
All right. Let's get right to it. First of all, some sort of interesting and odd breaking news, Kyle Wingfield. Everybody's in New Hampshire for good reason, Democrats and Republicans, except Donald Trump's not there. His campaign today changed their schedule. He's now in South Carolina. They say they can't get in because of the snowstorm, but I looked at all the flight trackers, including the FAAs, and flights are getting into Boston Logan, at least. He could be driving up the hour and a half to get into New Hampshire. Interesting if he's making a change of strategy at this point in the campaign, or maybe he really can't get the plane in. Who knows?
Yeah, absolutely, especially because we were just getting reports from up there that, unlike in Iowa, where he was mostly going for the big, grand political rally, more than the traditional retail handshake politics, that he was apparently listening to some advice to go for the more traditional route and was starting to do that, you know, visiting Lions clubs and the like up there. And so to take this detour, way south,
yeah.
4 days before the primary is it's peculiar, and it makes you wonder exactly where his head is right now and exactly where his expectations are and where he thinks everyone was thinking this is where he was going to make his stand.
You know, and we're going to talk in a little while about Trump very specifically and about the Republican race. But let us just say for the time being that we have learned to plumb the depths of the Trump mind is usually a losing game for those of us who follow politics.
If I'm right this time, it'll be the first time.
So. Let's start with our own Jimmy Carter. He went to London the other day, Todd Rehm, and he spoke at the House of Lords. Maybe one of you knows the backstory in this. I don't, and if you do, great. I don't know whether he was asked a question to which he responded or he just felt he needed to deliver an opinion of himself. Todd, you know?
I saw the video of it, and he was speaking to the House of Lords apparently about guinea worm eradication and
yes,
some of this stuff.
Exactly.
The Carter Center does, and he was asked afterwards in a press.
He was. Let's listen to what Carter said.
If I had a choice of Republican nominees, let's just say, for instance, between Cruz and Trump, I think I would choose Trump. Which may surprise some of you. But the reason is that Trump has proven already that he's completely malleable. I don't think he has any fixed opinions that he would really go to the White House and fight for. On the other hand, Ted Cruz is not malleable. He has far right-wing policies, in my opinion, that would be pursued aggressively if and when he might become president.
Todd, what do you make of Jimmy Carter and the way it's been handled by Ted Cruz in the aftermath?
My initial reaction was, if you gave him $10 million and a script written by Ted Cruz's screenwriters, it could not have hit the Cruz narrative better. Cruz has always been talking about how he's always putting principles first, and how he says Donald doesn't seem to have any. And it was just masterful. And you can't believe it was a mistake or something that just came out. You know, Jimmy Carter is an accomplished politician, has a sharp political mind. And I think he knew exactly what he was saying.
Are you suggesting that President Carter made those remarks because he wanted to boost Ted Cruz's chances with his voters out there?
I think at the very least he could not have been ignorant that was what the effect was going to be.
Okay, so Mike Thurman, Todd Rehm makes an interesting point about playing into Ted Cruz's hands. Cruz already has a commercial on the air about this. And what I find fascinating about this commercial is the only thing it is Carter making his comments. There's no announcer saying, if Jimmy Carter wants Donald Trump, don't you want? None of that. They have left it to voters to realize what Carter is saying and to make their own decisions about what this says about Ted Cruz as an independent voice.
It reminds me of an old Hosea Williams line, believe it or not. You know, the legendary Hosea Williams, when he was in the legislature, he would go up to rural white legislators who were his friends, and he said, look, I'll come to your district, and I'll be for you or against you, whatever will help you the most. And so, so in this case, he was doing, I think Todd hit it right on the nail. Well, I mean, I think that's exactly what he was doing.
Nan, I want to get you in, but Kyle, you're our conservative. You should react to what Todd said about Trump playing to Cruz intentionally.
Well, it does. When I hear that, it makes me wonder, does President Carter at least think the Democrats most want to face a Ted Cruz?
There you go. That is what I was hoping we'd get to, that you're both suggesting he's setting Cruz up as the better candidate for a Hillary Bernie to run again.
Which is pretty amazing, given all the talk for so long about how Trump would be the disaster for the Republicans and that he, you know, the Democrats couldn't wait to face him. Just as he appears to be sliding a little bit among the Republican field, it does seem maybe Democrats would rather take a shot at him instead of Ted Cruz.
But two things. One
the other way around, rather.
Yeah. One is that they saw for a number of months what appeared to be a Teflon Don, that nothing anybody threw at him was going to hurt. And so they didn't know any better than Republicans how to deal with this. And the second is that some of the polling seems to show that Trump gets a large chunk of the traditional Democratic base.
I was going to add that.
And it's hard to push him around ideologically. He's neither left nor right because he's both, whereas Cruz is much easier to say he's too far right.
Nan, you want to weigh in this?
Well, I'll also say that the Republican establishment, the ABC coalition is fast coming together, anybody but Cruz. They don't want to see Cruz, but precisely because of his sharp right-wing ideology. You know, he's the guy leading the path to shut down government, let us not forget. And they could coexist with a Trump more easily. And it is accurate to say that the populism of Trump is beguiling to a slice of the Democratic voters.
Kyle?
I agree with that last point. I do think part of the Anything But Cruz coalition is he just hasn't played nice with the other folks in Washington, and they maybe see Trump as more of a deal cutter. Maybe they have some misgivings about how far to the right he might tug the party. But I do think part of it is he's just ticked off a lot of his fellow senators
and they
see this as a chance to, you know, to head him off at the pass.
Let me weigh in and then turn to you, Todd. There's another thing at play here, I think, right? And that is that I think the establishment of the Republican Party believes that if Donald Trump, if he loses, he goes away, he's not going to bother anybody. But Ted Cruz is a potentially potent force in continuing the split in the Republican Party. Yes, is that right?
He is, yeah. And I don't think that there is an establishment recipe for healing that split other than stomping it out wherever it appears.
Yeah.
I was thinking, as Nan was talking, that you know maybe as we get towards March 1st, we may hear cuts of her saying that Trump would be easier to work with on the radio.
I should have said the feeling is that if Trump wins the nomination, you know, and loses the White House, he probably goes away. But Cruz becomes, even if he loses the White House, could become a leader of the Republican Party moving forward.
But what I said at the first Trump event I went to was, don't we as Republicans want him jetting around in the last 6 weeks of the campaign, even if he's not the nominee, getting people that excited?
Okay, let me do this, if you don't mind. Let's park a further discussion about the Republican race, because there's a lot to talk about. But we've got to go to what I think, we have two Democrats in this studio, one of the most exciting, and I think substantive within the talking point that they both turn to on many occasions, debates that I've certainly seen in a very, very long time. Last night, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders really going at each other. And I think it's, I'd like to suggest we look at this in terms of three themes that really emerged in this campaign. And we saw one of them very early on when Sanders and Clinton really went at each other over the way that she thinks he's characterizing her. Let's listen to this fight.
Senator Sanders has said he wants to run a positive campaign. I've tried to keep my disagreements over issues, as it should be. But time and time again, by innuendo, by insinuation, there is this attack that he is putting forth, which really comes down to, you know, anybody who ever took donations or speaking fees from any interest group has to be bought. And I just absolutely reject that, Senator. And I really don't think these kinds of attacks by insinuation are worthy of you. And enough is enough. If you've got something to say, say it directly. But you will not find that I ever changed a view or a vote because of any donation that I ever received. What? And I have stood up and I have represented my constituents to the best of my ability, and I'm very proud of that. You know, so I think it's time to end the very artful smear that you and your campaign have been carrying out in recent weeks. And let's talk about the issues. Let's talk about issues that divide us. We both agree with campaign finance reform.
Let's talk about issues.
I worked hard for McCain-Feingold. I want to reverse Citizens United.
Let's talk about issues. All right, let's talk about why in the 1990s Wall Street got deregulated. Did it have anything to do with the fact that Wall Street provided, spent billions of dollars on lobbying and campaign contributions? Well, some people might think, yeah, that had some influence. You know, there is a reason why these people are putting huge amounts of money into our political system. And in my view, it is undermining American democracy, and it is allowing Congress to represent wealthy campaign contributors and not the working families of this country.
All right. So, Senator Nan Orrick, excuse me, I let that play out a little longer because it was really a very interesting and angry exchange. It was good television, certainly. But it also really went in many ways to the heart of the way these two are maneuvering for the nomination. When you heard that, I wish that we were, this is one of those times I wish we were on TV, because when she said he should stop the smearing, Bernie Sanders' expression was absolutely priceless.
Yes, it was.
Go ahead, talk to us about this, Senator.
Well, it was a spirited debate, and a debate that caused Chris Matthews afterwards to ask Debbie Wasserman Schultz,
the chair of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, didn't he say, are Democrats just smarter or nicer? What was his question? But there's a lot of shared opinion that the Democratic Party and the Democratic principles, the Democratic candidates, looked very good and strong and bold in that evening, whichever candidate you're choosing to back.
Well, Kyle, one of the things that this back and forth illuminated was she's the candidate of Wall Street and he's the candidate of the grassroots, right?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, he would position
that's
it
certainly,
that way.
That's certainly the way he approached it and referred to her as being part of the establishment. You know, here again, we have a mirror of what's going on in the Republican debate, establishment versus populist in a lot of ways, and this sort of obsession over ideological labels. But, I thought it was interesting as I was watching it last night that she made this challenge to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he sort of shrank from it, right? I mean, he did go on to talk about, but that was kind of more the insinuation and innuendo that she'd right then challenged him to stop and make a direct accusation. And he never went on.
Was that a failure on his part, in your opinion?
I thought it was at the time. He did go on to make some points, what I remember from last night was his failure to do that. It reminded me of 4 years ago when there was a challenge from Romney to Tim Pawlenty, who had been referring to Obamacare or Romneycare.
Yeah.
Bridging the two together. And Romney basically challenged him on the debate stage to say it to his face, and Pawlenty totally didn't do it.
So
that hurt him, and it makes it. It reminded me of that, and it made me wonder if Sanders does get hurt from this, that shrinking back.
Well, so, Mike, I think one of the things Kyle suggests here, certainly Bernie Sanders could have said to her, well, you may say this all you want, Secretary Clinton, but I'm not the one who took $675,000 from Goldman's. I mean, there was ammunition there. He chose instead to refocus on his theme, which is the influence of big money in politics. I'm not sure a direct attack on Hillary Clinton after she said, you're smearing me. I know what Kyle's saying, but I wonder in the long run if it would have served him well.
Well, it could have, but to the point, he generally retreats at that point of contention over and over again. But Bill, this is deja vu all over again. I think about the 90s with the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, when former President Clinton tried to reposition the Democratic Party after multiple defeats at the national level with Mundell and others and Humphrey, when he said, look, we need to win. So what they were really arguing about, if you really listen to them, was Senator Sanders was talking more ideology and philosophy as the revolution in terms of what is right. And on the other hand, Secretary Clinton was trying to say, but look, unless you win and then govern, none of this makes much difference.
Well, yeah.
Pragmatist versus the idealist.
Well, and that's right.
That's what that was all about. We went through that in
exactly,
the 90s.
Exactly.
And we're back again.
Right.
And I think the issue of, point me at a vote that changed because of a campaign contribution was kind of a red herring. It's not about, greasy paper sacks full of cash for a vote on a specific issue. It's more subtle than that. It's about influencing the individual's worldview. And in addition to, having the opportunity to do that three times for $675,000, you're also flying her in a private jet to New York and surrounding her with that class, that moneyed class of people. And that cannot help over the course of 20 years that she's been at the highest level.
Yeah,
well, look, in all fairness, though, let's think about Citizens United.
I was going to say.
Let's think about a Republican Congress that has supported over and over and over again unlimited access to cash and to cash contributions by the rich and the wealthy. And it would make what really made no sense to me was to ask Secretary Clinton to unilaterally disarm, right? And knowing that you're up against what the Koch brothers are spending $750 million to influence the outcome of this election. And then to tell this candidate you should unilaterally disarm.
Well, I don't think he's suggesting she unilaterally.
Well,
because
the Wall Street money piece, you're taking money from Wall Street contributions, you have a super PAC. That's exactly what he's saying.
I mean, if people on the Republican side are troubled by that and think those allegations resonate, then they should be for taking down Citizens United.
Kyle, when we talk to reporters out there.
Kyle is smiling. He's not.
Well, no, let me make a point, and then you can jump in too, Todd. Reporters covering the campaign that I've talked to say that the single question that comes up time and time again from voters about Democratic candidates is, what is it with Hillary Clinton and Wall Street? I mean, this is an issue that, like it or not, and both of our Democrats today are supporting Clinton, it's got legs, it appears.
And the moment where I thought she took a real hit came a little bit later, when Chuck Todd asked her if she would release the transcripts from the speeches she gave to all these investment banks and others, you know, because she's been making this point, this case, that I was out there warning them that they were headed down this path that was going to lead us to ruin. And I don't know how often you get six-figure checks for going and telling people that they're about to ruin everything. So when Todd asked her, will you release the transcripts, a question she has been asked before, she said, I'll have to look into it. That is just one of those classic Clintonian dodges.
But these speeches for money, I famously remember George Bush Sr. Racking up enormous. The only person you can point to that's come off of a presidency that hasn't done that is Jimmy Carter. My point is this. These speeches that you're talking about do not go back in time. They are in this period, and it's not a thing uncommon about it. And Chris Matthews continued to ask last night, "What? These are made before thousands of people. What's to find out about a transcript?"
I'm not damning Republicans or Democrats. I'm just saying, let's be fair. And let's be honest.
Todd, jump in here.
If we aren't just talking about Citizens United and campaign money, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars into the personal pocketbook. And I understand that presidents in the past have done that, but George H.W. Bush did not run for president again after having done that. I think Kyle made that point very well.
It's a distinction without a difference.
And if you want to go out and tell the Democratic folks who are asking Bernie Sanders for free stuff that it's okay to pocket $250 cash for speaking to a bunch of investment bankers, have at it and make that argument to them all day long.
The credibility issue gets to, This is a specific claim she's made toward her.
All right, so let me. I've got to weigh in because we have to keep moving. So I have not seen reporting from the Clinton campaign press yet today. Maybe some of you have. I would be quite surprised if she isn't getting questions from her traveling press following up on Chuck Todd asking her this. And Senator, I wonder. You didn't really respond to Kyle on that. If she gave speeches, as she said, in which what she talked about was how hard it was to make the decision about going after Osama bin Laden and all, which I'm sure she did, were there other things she said to Goldman Sachs? That question remains open until she shows us the transcripts, doesn't it?
But people, excuse me. First of all, 11 hearings on Benghazi. And after all the questions, let me finish.
This isn't about Benghazi.
I know, but it's a thread. Nothing.
Okay.
Now emails.
All right.
Come to find out, Condoleezza Rice staff.
Absolutely.
Secretary, right?
Absolutely.
Colin
There's
Powell,
no question that the Republican thing. Case against Clinton on emails is hurt a bit by this new news that Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, we now know more, that they had classified emails,
too. But that's
too.
After hundreds right. of millions
right.
of dollars
All right.
spent.
All right. My turn. There was another theme in the debate last night that I want to get your reaction to, because it seems to me it plays into the hands of whoever the GOP nominee is going to be. And that is this whole question that they've batted back and forth, Clinton and Sanders, all week in New Hampshire. Who's a liberal? We don't say liberal anymore if you're a Democrat. Here's what they talked about in terms of who's a progressive, who's a moderate.
And it is fair to say, Senator, that in your definition, as you being the self-proclaimed gatekeeper for progressivism, I don't know anyone else who fits that definition. But I know a lot of really hard-fighting progressives in the Democratic Party who have stood up time and time again against special interests, against the powerful, on behalf of those who are left behind and left out. And that's what we ought to be celebrating. Let's talk about what we would do as president and commander-in-chief to make sure the progress continues into the future.
She got up and said something like, I have been, I'm paraphrasing, I have been criticized because people think I'm a moderate. Well, I am a moderate. That's where this came from. It wasn't me paraphrasing her. It is what she said. And all that I said is nothing wrong with being a moderate. But you can't be a moderate. You can't be a progressive.
So, Senator, I'm curious about something here. We are used to having the discussion about Republican primary races where we, where we see Republicans running to the right to win the nomination and then having to find their way back to the center to win a general election campaign. It strikes me that the longer that Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton argue about who's a moderate, who's a progressive, the more it tees them up. They've moving, the more they move to the left, they better run back to the center, because in a general election campaign, I would think a Republican is going to hammer them over the head because progressive, we know, is a synonym for liberal. Yeah? Am I wrong?
You know, progressive, the term progressive, I don't think today is a demonized term. The liberals invested mightily in making, the conservatives, the GOP invested mightily in making liberal a demonized term and making people run away from that. We embrace progressive, and it has a vision. It resonates with the sound of a vision and forward movement. I think Hillary will continue beyond the primary and into the general, stressing her ability to get things done.
Is Bernie Sanders
and that she can fight for, she can fight to continue the progress that we've made under the President Obama?
Okay, so this is a toss-up question: is Bernie Sanders forcing her so far to the left that it's going to be hard? The odds are she becomes the Democratic nominee. Has she been pushed so far to the left it's going to be hard for her to get back to the center?
I don't know that it's so much that he's pushed her to the left as he's pushed her to reveal how far left she is natively.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Okay. By the way, before we take a break and get off this, I understand to Mike Thurman and Ann Orrick, our Hillary Clinton supporters, that I was asking tough questions about her in the way she responded on Wall Street. It should be said, and I'd love to get everybody to do a quick round on this, she continues to be a phenomenal debater. She shows her smarts every time she gets up on a stage like that. So there's no question that she really knows how to sell her points. Yes?
I would agree. I thought her performance was outstanding last night. It was concrete. It was impassioned. It was friendly and welcoming and engaging. And it was long on facts. I thought she did a great job.
Kyle, what did you think?
Yeah, she was very well prepared. The one thing about the debate transcripts was the only time I really thought she got caught off guard. Bernie Sanders will not win the nomination on the debate stage, and she will not lose it there for sure.
Todd.
I think she's an accomplished politician. She's an accomplished debater. 25 years or whatever in politics will get you that. And for those who enjoy watching political debates, you've got to be looking forward to the possibility of seeing her and Ted Cruz on the same stage.
Mike Thurman, Todd Rehm just anticipated the last question, and I'm going to give it to you before we break. I did a little thought experiment last night. I thought, as I listened to what Hillary Clinton was saying, instead of seeing Bernie Sanders next to her, I thought, well, who's the Republican candidate standing here? How is it going to play with whoever that is? And vice versa if it's Sanders. In the thought experiment world, which one of those two in a debate, based on their philosophies, not on whether they're the best debater in the world, is going to stand a better chance against the Republican candidate?
I think it's Senator Clinton. But
because why? I know you support her, but why?
Well, basically because of what's already been stated, the experience, her ability on foreign policy.
I'm talking about on a debate stage.
On a debate stage.
Yes.
She, again, I think it's her. But let me say this. What Senator Sanders has done, and we can't underestimate it or downplay it, he has tapped into a sentiment, or energy, even a movement that's changing the face of the Democratic Party politics.
All right.
And I want to get, since we don't have a representative here from Senator Sanders, I'm going to put on my Sanders hat.
We invited.
I would agree with you. Yeah.
Thank you. Just to be clear, we invited the Sanders representative here, LaDawn Jones, state legislator, to be with us today. She couldn't be. She's out of town. She is going to be in this studio next Friday to make Bernie Sanders' case. So, and to be honest, once you move past her, it's hard to find a real spokespeople for right. Sanders yet. Now, we'll see if he does well.
Absolutely. But, you know, Bill.
All right. We got to take a break. Okay. I've got to interrupt you, Mike.
All right. No
Look,
problem.
It's 3:36. We haven't even taken a break, and we're already more than a half hour into the show, Mike.
Well,
give me a
Bill.
Chance. You're listening to Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Good afternoon. You're
People who live near a major natural gas leak have a lot of questions about their health, and they're getting conflicting answers.
Is there anything I should be concerned about that might be long term? The answer is no.
Well, I think that is probably an overly optimistic interpretation.
Health and the Porter Ranch gas leak on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 until 7 on GPB.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Political Rewind on Georgia Public Broadcasting, an 18-station radio network. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, offering 55 undergraduate and graduate degree programs in more than 250 fields of study.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Kyle Wingfield, Senator Nan Orrick, Mike Thurman, Todd Rehm, all at the table today. The Republican race in New Hampshire, Kyle, getting more and more interesting. Trump in the polls, the tracking polls that we're in now, have him up by about 10 points, it appears. But they show Rubio coming on strong, Cruz trailing Rubio by a little bit. It appears, and help me with this, that it is Rubio more than Trump or Cruz who has real momentum going into the final 4 days of the race. Yes?
It looks that way to me. I think so. I think he was Trump was the surprise on the downside in Iowa, certainly. But Rubio was the one who surprised on the upside. Cruz, everybody knew Cruz had a chance of doing what he did. That wasn't so much of a surprise that he hit his number so much as that Trump fell to the one he had. But then that, you know, again, that Rubio rose up there. I think the question for me Tuesday night is you assume those three. And then is there anyone else who even breaks into double digits to make it more than a three-man race going forward? And I'm not sure right now that we will see that.
So we have a huge debate coming up tomorrow. Oh, my gosh, I'm sounding like Trump. We have a really big debate coming up tomorrow night. And, Todd, here's what's fascinating about it is all those Republicans take the stage. I think, and you may know because you're a poll guy, I think 40% of the voters in New Hampshire identify themselves as independents or somewhere near that, a huge percentage, and they usually break late. New Hampshire voters are famous for waiting until the very last minute to make their choices, and with a big debate on Saturday night, I think all bets are off that the polling right now may not tell us a true picture of where this campaign stands.
I think what we've seen the entire cycle and going back into 2014 is that polling is not the tool that does what the public and a lot of journalists think it does. I think that part of the story of the momentum coming out of Iowa has to be the momentum of the changes, not just in direction, but in scale that occurred between the last poll in Iowa and that actual poll day, where if you're talking about momentum, you can say that Cruz started an upward momentum 5-6 days before that. Trump started 5 or 6 days before that. And so I think that I'm not gonna make any bets on the night before the New Hampshire election based on what the polls say.
Well, so okay, let's listen to a little bit of the sound coming out of New Hampshire this weekend. Here's one of the reasons I want to do it. It's been interesting that if Rubio is the candidate on the rise, that Trump has chosen for at least 3 or 4 days coming out of Iowa to focus his attacks on Ted Cruz. Strange choice, it seems to me. Let's listen to one example of that and then talk about whether I'm wrong.
I think what he did is disgusting. He said that Ben Carson, who's a fantastic guy, had dropped out of the race. I think it was a disgrace that he did it, and I don't think it should be even allowed. I think those votes should be taken away, and there were plenty of them.
Okay, so of course that's Donald Trump saying that dirty tricks on the Cruz team's part played into the results of Iowa. And he made that point for a couple of days. He kept after that for a couple of days. And then Ted Cruz has been saying this about Trump.
Donald does not want to defend his lifelong support for socialized medicine, for Bernie Sanders-style socialized medicine. Donald wants to expand Obamacare so that the federal government is in charge of your health care and my health care, is in charge of your doctor and my doctor. But it is exactly the opposite of my view. My view is, if I'm elected president, we're going to repeal every word of Obamacare. Donald doesn't want to discuss that issue. He doesn't want to discuss his support for eminent domain, for taking private property and giving it to giant corporations and casinos. So instead he engages in insults. I think the people are interested in substance and record and a positive, optimistic vision.
So, Todd, you are a consultant. You work with campaigns. Would you have advised Donald Trump to be going after Ted Cruz, or should he have been trying to tarnish Marco Rubio to some extent in the last few days?
It goes back to a polling memo I sent you a week or two ago from John McLaughlin, who did a national poll. And what he really keyed in on, and I think this is the answer, is that people who are choosing Marco Rubio, when they're asked their second choice, they go to Cruz over Trump at a 2-to-1 ratio. So if Trump goes after Rubio, two of every votes he knocks off of Rubio goes to his opponent. There's much more overlap both among voters and ideologically between Trump and Cruz. And so if Trump wants to gain votes and take Cruz down, that's the only place he goes is after Cruz.
Okay. Kyle, I want to continue with our little sound trip through New Hampshire, if I may, because you mentioned the establishment candidates fighting for position. Certainly Jeb Bush is one, John Kasich another. There are those who think that Jeb's got to have a fairly good finish here, but he'll almost certainly go on to South Carolina because they think South Carolina is a very hospitable climate for the Bush family. Before you talk about that, let's listen to what Jeb Bush is saying on the trail in New Hampshire.
Every candidate has to have their record examined. Every candidate has to earn it. There should be no coronations here. And my case is, I'm a conservative, and I've proved it by doing it, by being a governor of the state where I applied conservative principles. Marco Rubio is a gifted politician, but his whole life has been around his own ambitions. And he's gifted. He can turn a phrase really well. But what has he done?
So what's your take on, is Jeb really going to just hang on in New Hampshire and then head down here and hope things get better for him in the sunny South?
Well, I mentioned earlier, I want to see that fourth place, whether that fourth place is in single digits or double digits, like, you know, we saw the single in Iowa. And in other words, what separation there is between third and fourth. I do think of the, at this point, the not top three candidates, I do think Jeb is the only one who can go to a South Carolina and beyond and have the kinds of showings that could get him back into the race. I'm not sure he will pull that off. I just don't see John Kasich doing it. I don't see Chris Christie doing it. So he will soldier on because of that possibility, I think. He just hasn't had it this entire campaign. And I don't see him getting that spark now either. I really don't know where that's going to come from, if it's going to come for him.
It's probably a kiss of death, but I hope John Kasich does better because he's been, to me, the most impressive of all the candidates. He's substantive, he's thoughtful, and I just think he brings a lot to the discussion.
Well, why don't we listen to what John Kasich's saying on the trail this week and bring you in, Dan Orrick. Mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter is I am a conservative. And somehow people want to put out this notion because I care about, my tone is good, because I care about the mentally ill, the drug addicted, and the working poor, and the developmentally disabled, and members of the minority community, that somehow that disqualifies me as a conservative. I will come to what you asked. If the conservative Republican Party does not care about people who live in the shadows, we will fail.
You know, Nan Orrick, it sounds an awful like George W. Bush, compassionate conservative, coming from John Kasich. But that's a message that could resonate in a general election, couldn't it?
I can't see Kasich getting out of the Republican primary in a million years for exactly that perspective that he just put forward. I don't think that resonates with the base. I applaud what he's done with expanding Medicaid in Ohio, for example. He has done formidable work in Congress, heading up the budget process. There's no question about his talent. I cannot see that party choosing him.
So let me. Well, go ahead, Kyle.
I think where a lot of conservative voters maybe get frustrated with a John Kasich. And by the way, if you call him a compassionate conservative, as I suggested when he was here last summer, he will snarl at you.
Yeah, he doesn't like it.
He does
That's
not
right.
like that term.
That is so true.
But it's falling into the trap that Democrats like to set for Republicans, which is unless you're for our solution, you're not really conservative. And I think a lot of conservative voters, they do want to show compassion for a lot of those groups, but they want a Republican and a conservative solution to show that compassion rather than adopting what has been put forth by the Democrats.
Todd, let's bring this all back to Georgia if we can. So we're going to have New Hampshire on Tuesday. Then we're going to have a Nevada caucus. Mm-hmm. And then March 1st becomes the next big, real big test. And that's the SEC primary in which Georgia will play a big, big role, we imagine. How many candidates on the Republican side get a ticket out of New Hampshire from your point of view?
I tend to agree with Kyle with respect to Bush being probably the only of the second-tier candidates who has a chance of going much further. But I was reading an article, and I think it was the Wall Street Journal.
You mean second-tier, not second establishment,
right.
Second-tier.
Right, second-tier.
Okay.
Well, sometimes that's the same thing, but here that's not what I meant.
Okay.
I was reading an article that there are some folks who still harbor some anxiety over whether there's another shoe to drop for Marco Rubio with respect to financial issues. And I can see that being a compelling reason for somebody, if you have done respectably in one state at least by the time we get to March 1st, saying, I'm going to stick in because we don't know. Trump may collapse, Rubio may collapse, Cruz could collapse for all we know. And there's got to be somebody still there.
Okay, so with all due respect to Kyle and his colleagues at the Atlanta Constitution, really, I don't know anybody who has their ear to the ground in Republican politics in Georgia the way you do. Cruz still, am I right, has the operation down here that is built to really last, yes?
I would say that Cruz has the number one grassroots team here. But I will also say that Trump has shown some signs of building out. And not just since Iowa, from shortly before Iowa, but he had his campaign headquarters opening. They've got a list of six or eight county areas where they're having Trump meetings every week, every 2 weeks. They had an event in South Georgia, probably the first presidential election event ever held in Terrell County, Georgia, and they had 600 people there. And so you can't. Trump starts with a 6 to 9 month lag behind Cruz, but he's starting to build something.
But you got to be impressed with a guy like Rubio who finished third and stood up there and gave a victory speech.
We have to take our final break, but before we do, you may know this, Kyle, but I don't see a great organization for Marco Rubio down here yet.
He's getting more and more elected officials who are endorsing him and supporting him, whether that's translating into what you typically call the ground game. I haven't really seen a lot of that, Todd.
Nan Orrick, before we're going to have to take a break, but I want to give you one chance before we do. Let's go back to the Democrats just for a moment because the campaign is headed south. There are those who would say that Hillary Clinton probably recognizes her campaign smart. Bernie Sanders got a great start on her in New Hampshire. She probably brings it down to single digits, but still doesn't beat him because it's his neighboring state, among other things.
Sure.
So in some ways, when you listened to her the other night, to go back to the debate last night, Is she beginning to talk beyond New Hampshire? And how do you think Democrats in Georgia are going to feel about the way she presented herself last night?
I think she's going to find a great big welcome mat in Georgia among Democrats. She has been in and out of the state and has built out. She was very supportive of the Michelle Nunn campaign, for example. And Michelle Nunn was a huge favorite in our ranks in her race. My expectation is that, and I'll direct your listeners to MediaMatters.com if you want to take a look at how much beating up on Hillary because she's a woman. They've quantified the attacks on her on that, and the Clintons do well in the South. The Clintons do well in the South. Right. I expect good things.
All right.
The
clock is pushing us forward. Let's take a break. You're listening to Political Rewind at 3:51. Back in a moment.
For nearly 3 weeks every spring, the Savannah Music Festival fills downtown venues with performances by renowned artists in jazz, classical, and American and international roots music. The 2016 festival begins on March 24th with more than 100 concerts. Details at savannahmusicfestival.org.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Mike Thurman, Todd Rehm, Senator Nan Orrick, and Kyle Wingfield at the table with us today. Real quick, Kyle, a subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee took pretty quick action and moved this so-called Pastor Protection Act, originated by David Ralston, the Speaker of the House, on in the process. So let me offer you a take and see if you think this is correct. There are a lot of religious freedom bills, we've talked about them in the show, that a number of people on both sides of the aisle find somewhat unpalatable. Pastor Protection Act, which says you don't have to perform a gay marriage. Is it moving fast because that's the one bill that people feel is acceptable?
I think it's moving fast because the House really wants to have something that they can point to as their religious liberty bill. You know, the ones that we've talked about mostly before have come out of the Senate, and I think House members are tired of getting beaten up for not having something. I think it's gonna get out of there, and then we may find ourselves in a bit of a holding pattern while everybody sort of sorts out exactly what, if anything, they really want to do on this topic.
Senator, of all of the those religious freedom bills, am I right to suggest that perhaps in your Democratic caucus on the Senate side, the pastor protection bill is a little more palatable to everyone? Or do you not want that one either?
Well, the pastor protection bill just simply states the current reality. There's not a problem with it. It's not going to change anything on the landscape. If it relieves the heartburn of some on the right, well and good. I would say there's going to be a big mobilization of the Capitol by folks that are opposing these other measures. And that'll be Tuesday. Billy Graham's son was down there last week. I am seeing the GOP, and I think mistakenly, shifting all of their weight to the right wing of the GOP in Georgia to promoting this religious liberty approach. And I don't think they'll win it in the long run. And it alienates business, and it puts the leadership of the GOP down at the Capitol in a very precarious position.
Todd?
I think this is a pressure relief valve, pure and simple. There are a lot of members, especially from outside Metro Atlanta, of the Republican caucus, who are terrified to go back, and when they're asked, what did you do, say, well, we had the seven deadly sins session. We did marijuana. We did craft beers. We legalized horse racing and casino gambling.
Oh, and by the way, in the last session, now we're up for re-election, we gave you a tax increase to pay for transportation initiatives.
I'm not sure if that goes under pride, gluttony, or what. But it is purely a political pressure relief valve. And I believe that it's this coming Wednesday that Franklin Graham is
right.
at the...
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, I think
he's,
that's
he's
right.
They brought 150 pastors last week. They brought 150
that's
pastors.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Separate events.
So, Todd, in a way you're agreeing with me, I think. You know, the faster you move that through, the more it does relieve pressure for some members who are not enthusiastic about the other measures.
I'm skeptical of how much pressure it really relieves, because if you'll notice, none of the pro-religious liberty bill folks spoke in favor of that bill at that hearing. They're not opposing it, but they're not going to accept it as, well, we get this and now the issue's gone. It's not that they don't want this. They just don't see it as nearly satisfying the issue that they think they have.
Okay, that's thank you. That's a really good perspective. Mike Thurman, real quick, local note. There's been a great big story, good story in the AJC today about the fight over the Ford plant, about the vision for the Ford plant up there at 285 to be turned into a mega development that would bring enormous economic benefits. You were once the superintendent of DeKalb County Schools, and the school board out there has to sign off on this because tax money of theirs is involved, and so far they're being reluctant to do it. How do you read that in about a minute?
Well, first of all, I think the work of a delegation chair, Howard Mosby, will be critical. I'm hopeful that the different parties from the school board, Dr. Johnson, the developers can come to the table and work together and fashion a compromise. This would be a huge, huge step forward for DeKalb, for Metro Atlanta, for the state of Georgia, and we are extremely hopeful that this will happen. The testimony by Chris Carr yesterday was
head of state
stunning.
Development
was stunning,
right,
that he gave before the delegation. And obviously, we need to get off square one, come together, develop a solution that protects the resources for the district, but also allows the county to move.
Well, that's going to be a fascinating local story, or metro-wide story to watch develop in the months ahead, I think. Kyle, one last quick note from you. The MARTA bill to find money to expand MARTA seems to already be in trouble. Yes?
Well, there is a little bit different development on it. The bill got put in the quote-unquote wrong committee.
With a hostile chair.
A hostile committee.
no one seems quite able to explain how that happened. That now there's another bill, if I understand right, that is going to end up in the quote-unquote better committee. And so, but you know,
there's late breaking news on that, though, Kyle.
What's that?
And that is that the chair of the better committee is demurring. He is saying, nope. It's over there. This bill's over there in the government,
like
the operations
happen,
committee,
yeah.
And that's where it's going to stay. So it turns out both chairs are hostile to progress on this issue.
Dan Orrick, you now get about 20 seconds. The Metro Atlanta Chamber released an economic report impact study saying it would be worth millions and millions, maybe billions of dollars to extend MARTA. But it looks like the critics aren't taking it seriously because so often economic impact studies seem to be questioned by the people who don't like the project involved.
Well, I think that the GOP leadership at the Capitol is between a rock and a hard place. Business is asking them to come to the table and help us move forward. Economic development, mass transit's part of it. Come on, guys, let's get on board. And they're still, the train is at the station.
You got the last word in. So Senator Nan Orrick, Kyle Wingfield, Todd Ream, Mike Thurman, it was really wonderful. You get a great conversation today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
You're listening to Political Rewind. We're going to be back with you next Wednesday. Wednesday morning, I'll be on Morning Edition with Bradley George to talk about the results of the Tuesday night New Hampshire primary. Tuesday night, I'll be over at CBS 46 at 11 to do a little analysis at that point. By the way, for those of you who are two-way street fans, tomorrow we're going to play a really, really moving conversation with Kathleen Jordan and Dorothy Jordan. Dorothy Jordan, Hamilton Jordan's widow, and his daughter. It's really a powerful show. Tune in.